Okay, let's get started. Good morning again, everybody. I'm so excited to be here with Amanda Stern, and as I said, we'll be joined by Millicent Bennett, who is an editor at Grand Central Publishing and is the editor of Amanda's book. Amanda is the author of The Long Haul, as well as 11 books for children, and her brand new memoir, Little Panic.
Yep.
I was going to say Panic Little, but Little Panic, which is an amazing book. I just finished it this week. You should all read it. It will be for sale this afternoon at the Posman Book Bookseller after our agent pitch session. So Amanda's going to start today with a reading from the book, and then we'll have a conversation about how it came to be published and how she worked with Millicent. Millicent will be here by that time, and we'll open it up to questions from all of you. So without further ado, Amanda, come on up. Oh, this is tall.
Sorry. Is that too tall?
Everything's too tall.
Whatever you're comfortable with. Yeah.
I think every podium should come with an apple box. Small people. So I'm going to read a tiny bit today. So the book is about growing up with an undiagnosed panic disorder in Greenwich Village during the time of the disappearance of Eitan Peetz, who was a little boy who went missing in 1979. And I was afraid of everything, but my main fears were disappearing and something happening to my mother. So I never really left her. I went undiagnosed until I was 25, and here's Millicent. And, no worries, I was just about to start reading.
Excellent.
Where was I? I went undiagnosed until I was 25, and I thought I would just read to you a little bit from a portion that takes place in this neighborhood. So things you need to know, it's my first day of a new school, one where they've made me repeat a grade. I've been getting nonstop IQ testing instead of the help I needed, and I don't know why I'm getting IQ tested, I'm getting IQ tested. I assume it's because I'm not doing it. I'm terrified of being kidnapped. A couple of other kids who went missing, just in case I reference them, Marcy Klein, Eitan Peetz. Also, I have panic attacks. I don't know it yet. No one does. I'm taking public transportation alone for the first time in my life.
Oh, what age again?
I am 12. Hi. all right. If you see nodding, that means either of us would be like, oh, we need to tighten that line. my mother said the bus will drop me off on 5th Avenue and 8th Street, and all I have to do is walk straight, right through Washington Square Park. Easy peasy. Once we're at 14th Street, I realized I'm the only one on the bus. Marcy Klein was on the bus when she was kidnapped. I stand and check that we're going in the right direction. My breath is starting to thicken, but then the arch for the park's entrance comes into view and I calm down, ring the bell, and stand near the door. But instead of stopping where he's supposed to on 8th Street, he turns left and keeps going away from the park. My colon spasms and a noose lassos around my neck. I feel the slip knot tightening into the hollow of my throat. I can't get air. I'm being kidnapped. No one can save me. I start swallowing at the air to get some into my lungs, pulling whatever I can through my nose and nostrils to keep me alive. Please let me off the bus. I will do anything you want. I will be nice to Holly, my stepsister. I will not think bad thoughts about other people. Is he slowing down? He's slowing down. Oh, thank God, thank God, thank God. He stops. But the moment between stopping and opening the door feels like a lifetime, and I worry that he's changing his mind, and he's going to look into the rearview mirror, spit out an evil laugh, press the gas, and steal me away. But then I hear the deep wheeze and the door accordions open. I fly out, entangled in relief and terror, and having no idea where I am or how to get home. I don't know where the park is. I was paying attention only to being kidnapped, not to where the bus was going. The bus did something different from what my mom said it would do, and I can't adjust for that difference. I can stay true only to the direction as they directions as they are, and only from the place I'm supposed to be, not wherever I am. Maybe if I walk straight, I'll hit the park. My mom is always right, so even though there was an error, she'll still be right. I walk straight, but the park does not appear, and the neighborhood starts feeling shady, and I become more lost. Now the fear that hit me blocks ago turns crippling. I turn and look behind me. What were buildings and sidewalks on my way here now look like shapes and textures. Windows are rectangles, two-dimensional drawings. I'm hit by an ominous, tumbling sense that I've fallen into some replica of reality, the world flattened into two dimensions. Colors are beige and muted and stretch into one another. As everything starts to double, I feel myself rise up above it all, vibrating. I'm lifting above the city like mist, and all of a sudden I know what's really going on. People are just game pieces being played on a city-sized board. Everything looks fake, like it's been illustrated. Even the bricks look drawn on. Roof shingles are rectangles darkened by charcoal. The cars look like paper cutouts, and cracks in the sidewalk are drawn on by chalk. Everything is a farce. Nothing is true. Abruptly, I have seen life for what it is. We are all objects without meaning. The meaning comes from the giant invisible hands that are playing their game with us. An early fall chill. Someone is lowering the sun, and immediately I know my entire family has gone on without me, not noticing I'm even missing. I imagine my family doing things they don't even do, sitting around a campfire, reading aloud from a book, playing guitar, laughing at jokes now that I'm gone. Kara's bracy grin, the boyish glint of Eddie's squinty laugh, the things I'll never see again. I walk fast toward the nearest store, determined to make them save me. The cool sweeping mist of each big breath puffs and dragon blasts through the inside of me. They didn't have enough information to keep him in jail, so they let the drainpipe man go. Now I know that anyone who passes me could be the drainpipe man. Little kids dash zigzag in a burst down the street toward me, little darting faces, their carefree laughs, squinting eyes, uneven mouths, baby teeth, and crooked little chins look suddenly both ominous and endangered. I duck into Bolton's, where the women on staff wear white stockings and pleated blue skirts. I don't realize I'm crying until someone calls for tissues. They coddle me and give me a lollipop. When they talk baby talk, I realize they think I'm younger than I am. This is a common problem. Sometimes I wish I were still nine, not the bad nine where Melissa and Baba died, my best friend grandfather, when Eitan disappeared, but the nine where people tried to protect me from the real world. Usually when people do find out that I'm older than they thought, they gasp in disbelief and I feel like apologizing. I'm not being who they expected me to be. When my mom rushes in, she thanks the women who work there and I'm relieved she looks as worried as I feel. Out on the sidewalk, I expect her to ask someone where we are or hail a taxi, but instead she walks down the block and there in front of us is the park. I don't understand. It was right there the entire time. I try to explain what the bus did and how hard I tried to follow her map. I wonder if your ambidexterity caused the problem, she says. It didn't, I say. I'll find you a tutor, she says, walking fast as we approach the park. I don't want a tutor. I just want someone to help me inside my body. If I can explain what happened, maybe she'll finally hear me, but I don't know the words. I got overwhelmed, I say. A tutor can help you with your problems following directions, she says. They can work with you after school. She clutches her purse to her chest, pulling me behind her. I have problems following directions? Maybe if someone walked the route with me from start to finish, then I'd know how to do it the right way, I say. I'll draw the map so it's clearer for you. I should have labeled the stores and restaurants and not just the streets, she says. I'll make the letters bigger. Maybe they were too small. I don't think that was the problem, I say. Can you walk faster, she says, her face pinched and drained of color. I hurry behind her through the park, passing a guy on a unicycle, juggling pins, a man blowing giant soap bubbles toward the little kids who chase them, a musician singing James Taylor songs, and my age kids dancing for change next to a blasting boombox. Those people don't seem scary, but I must be wrong. My mom pulls on my hand. There are so many things to fear in this world. I'm even starting to fear myself. I am a growing constellation of errors. I don't know what's wrong with me, only that something is, and it must be too shameful to divulge, or so rare that even the doctors are stumped. Whatever the case, not knowing is making everything worse. Is there some truth about myself no one will tell me? Whenever I ask, the answer is always the same. I have problems learning. When I push for more information, my mom gets flustered and says, I can't explain it. She's keeping something from me, I can tell. I try so hard to shake away the images, but I feel them coming. Trouble learning how to tell time. Bad grades, failing grades, ERB, Dr. Ripka, staying back a grade. The notes the other kids took, getting lost. My heart sinks at the realization of the absolute hard truth. I'm dumb. The adults lied to me. My mom lied to me. I didn't stay back because I was little. I stayed back because I'm stupid. That's how I know that no matter how many tutors she hires or maps she makes, I won't get it right. I don't understand how to do things. Other people know facts that I don't, and not knowing even things I never learned is dumbness. Everyone else's brains have information my brain doesn't. I don't want anyone to know this truth about me. It has to stay hidden. On top of being stupid, though, I know there's something else, the source of my worries that no one seems able to find. If the world discovers that I have a weird extra flaw on top of being stupid, who knows what grade they'll put me in? Who knows what will happen to me? Who I am is a secret I have to keep forever. As we rush home through Washington Square Park, I smell the hot dog carts, the pretzel stands, the fall pollen, new clothes, the faded perfume, and our fear. The sense that we're just a board game has stayed with me, and I feel like I know things about the world no one else does. The map is crumpled up and grimy in my hand. I'm crushing the very streets I am racing through, even home. Every smell cements this one terrifying experience inside me, and the truth about myself I now understand. From now on, all perfect New York City fall evenings will forever call up in me this specific terror and an exquisite sadness every September for the rest of my life. And
thank you so much, Amanda. I love that, especially that part of the book. I mean, I love the whole book. The book is amazing. Sorry?
Yeah, it's hard to hear.
Talk up, sure.
Because of the, yeah.
No mics?
Of course.
No mics.
So we don't have any mics, but we will project. Yeah. Your book is so poignant, and that passage especially, the idea of how we as children take responsibility for so many things that we don't necessarily have to, is just so moving. And it's also a beautiful portrait of New York City during the 70s and 80s. I wanted to just start by asking a few questions of Amanda about what inspired the book, what made you want to write it.
I didn't want to write it. What happened was that I had this source material.
Yeah.
I had all the test evaluations that I had taken my whole life, and I had been given these evaluations when I was about 35, and I thought, this is amazing. I have to do something with this. And I also wanted to use IQ testing in some way. So I started writing a novel, and it just didn't feel right. It wasn't working, so I started another novel, and that really wasn't working either, so I just started another novel. So I did this four times.
Wow.
Yeah, because I'm not, so bright. And and then finally I was like, you know what, I think that I'm avoiding the thing that I'm supposed to be writing, which is my story. So maybe if I just get that out, I can return to one of these millions of novels and keep going. So I started to write I started to get the story out, and I was incorporating the IQ test, and I was incorporating the evaluations, and just stylizing my own little thing, and it felt like the thing I was supposed to be writing. Mm-hmm. And so I just kept going, and so long to the other novels. So that was that.
Did you write it quickly? I mean,
no. I did not. It took me 4.5 years. I wrote the my past, the kids section, really quickly, and then it was like I got stunted and I couldn't move forward beyond like age 12, and so I just kept on writing the same things over and over again, sort of, and had like hundreds of pages of the exact same thing. And but then I realized I had to put in my present day stuff, but I didn't really know so much what about my present day, and that's where Millicent was incredibly, like, invaluably helpful. But I know we're going to get to that part.
Yeah.
So I'll save that.
Okay. Well, we don't have to save it. Do you want to just jump in and talk a little bit? I mean, I think it's good because the book just came out, it's important to know that it starts when you're a little, what
six,
age?
Six years
old, and it goes through your childhood,
mm-hmm.
And sort of flashes back from adult age to your childhood,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And interspersed throughout the book are, as you said, the testing,
IQ
records,
tests, the evaluations, yeah.
And I will say that one of the things that I found so compelling in reading it is there is this narrative rush, especially around the childhood years,
mm-hmm.
and it's so impressive that you were able to capture that feeling of being a kid in such a clear, precise way with such rigor. I mean, it's very, very transporting. You know, you really get a sense of that idea of being a little kid. How did you come in, Millicent, as the editor, to sort of help Amanda bring in the adult perspective or whatever it was that you weren't able to access right away?
It was already there. There was a lot that was there. And we just, as soon as we started working together, we got together for a really kind of epic coffee date, I think, and sat down and like mapped out the book and figured out what the key points were, because it was long, and the idea
very long.
The idea was we wanted to figure out what absolutely needed to stay, what could be compressed, could leave, but it all happened and it was all important enough for Amanda to put it down, so I needed her help to sort of say, these are the moments that, to me, were turning points in my life, you know, and then we figured out how to build to those and mm-hmm. come off of them and head to the next one. But, so we mapped it out for a while, and then we just went in and did the line edits. And I think one of the big questions was how did the two parallel stories, the childhood part, which is so compulsive, and the adulthood part, which is very much about your relationships, and how did those two speak to each other? How did they play off each other? Why did we need each part? And to me, I don't know. Maybe it's weird to talk about someone else's life story analytically when you're not don't have a degree in medicine.
I do it all the time.
But you know, the thread that we saw was the idea of this craving for a family, this craving for a sort of safe space and a home, which is also part of the, you know, the story of your house too.
Right. And when she says we, she means her. So well, I'm just going to jump in quickly and say that when we were figuring out sort of what the themes were, she was able to see what I couldn't see and point out, you know, well, this is all seems to be about, I was just stuck in my body, and like, this is about panic, this is about anxiety, this is about overwhelm. She was like, okay, but it's also maybe about like home. And I was like, yes! There were things that she could see that I could not see, and it was, and I don't know if I would have been able to see it, you know, until elderly in a home. But she was really great about diplomatically pointing out what was very obvious, but not to me. And so once that was figured out, it was much easier to sort of write to that and shape things to that idea, which was so right. It was just so apt.
In terms of the writing process, because this is a memoir, did you ever feel stalled because you're writing about real people?
Oh, yeah.
And was there a process that you went through where you shared what you were doing with real people? Like, I want you to read this because I'm going to publish this book.
Yes, but that was later.
That was later.
I stalled. I was really worried about my mom. And, you know, my mom has a sort of Trumpian, like, she's a liberal, but she has a Trumpian, like, inability to accept any criticism, and a criticism could be, she snapped at me, and she would be very upset and would lash out at me, and I was really afraid of that. I was afraid that she would cut me off, or that she would make me choose, you know, you either publish this book or you have me as your mom. Mm-hmm. And that really stopped me for a while, and my sister lives in Israel, and I made a lot of long-distance phone calls to her, and was sobbing, and she, you know, she was really helpful. She was just like, look, do you want to live your entire life, you know, based on your fear of mom's reaction, or do you want to live your life as a writer?
Right.
And, you know, and, yes?
I was going to say, speaking of things that writers can't see for themselves, I thought The Portrait of Her Mother was one of the most sort of complex and loving portraits in there. You know, I understand what it's like to be a human being and feel like anybody looking at you sideways can be a criticism, especially your daughter.
Right.
But objectively, you know, I think once you step back
yes.
from it, which is again, like, my job as an editor is just giving that sort of outsider feedback.
And that was, you know, a choice that I did have to make was, okay, is this story about me or is it about my family and my parents' neglect or mild abuse or whatever it is? And I thought, you know what, this is not their story.
Right.
I am gonna put forth the nicest version that I can of them, because it doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't really ultimately matter.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted people to live inside my anxiety and to know what that felt like. That was the experience that was important. And but it did stop me, and Millicent talked me through it, my sister talked me through it, and then I finally did show my family. My siblings read it first. They loved it, of course, because they look like superheroes. And then my parents read it, and the thing that I knew but I relearned, and that you'll discover, is that no one is upset about the things that you worry they're going to be upset about. Ever. I mean, it's, my dad was like, okay, well, so on page 33 there's a misspelling. I was like, all right, well, that's not about, go on, you know. And then there was another thing he was upset about child support or something, and I was like, okay. And my mom was like, please don't say that I got in a fight with Jimmy. I was like, I won't say that you fought with your husband. Done.
So it went well.
It went well.
Yeah.
I mean, well, I will say this. I don't know if you know this, but the day that... So my mom... All right. So I gave the book to my mom, and she immediately called my sister and said, I just don't have time to read a 400-page book. And then the next call from her, she said to my sister, I mean, I'm just not used to reading long things. I read things online now. And then the next thing was, I really only read political blogs. I mean, how am I supposed to read this? And then finally, so I was getting all this from my sister. And then the next day, I started to get these texts from my mom, who was clearly reading the book. She was like, I never said this. When did I say this? And then, that is absolutely incorrect. I was like, okay. The whole day was like, a puncture wound after puncture wound of like yelling at me through text. And then the next day she writes me and she goes, this was absolutely wonderful. You're a freak. So there you go.
That's great.
And if you dedicate it to your parents, everything works out. Yeah.
So listening to Amanda tell that story, I realized that as an editor, every author also goes through it. Like, you mail the edits back to them. I'm sure you did this too. And, like, you mail the edits back to them. And then you wait. And some people you don't hear from for, like, a week.
Uh-huh.
And when they write back and they're like, okay, I've processed. And, you know, like, 90% of these sound totally good. I'm still working on the other 10%. You know, what's your deadline? Fine. The more communicative authors will either themselves or through their agents immediately write back and say, I can't do this. What are you doing? And then 2 hours later, they'll say, okay, well, there's one thing in here that kind of made sense, but the rest is just, what have you done? And over the course of a night or a weekend, they will come around to say, oh my God, this is genius, and I'm doing everything. And
tell a story that you, what is it, are you referencing the...
No, I wasn't talking about you at all.
Oh, okay, because there was a phone call where I was like crying and hyperventilating.
There was that one, yes. But it's interesting, you know, just as writers, right. Like, think about how if you get edits and you think, oh my God, what has this person who I totally trusted up until 5 minutes ago done to my baby?
Yeah.
Like, what's going on here? Why doesn't she understand what I need, what I've done, what I want? And then, like, realize that everybody feels that way, that every kind of edit is going to feel that way, and that, like, I mean, your editor could be an idiot. That's totally possible. You don't have to agree with him or her, but if you feel, like, attacked, just remember, everybody goes through that, you know, and apparently mothers, too.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of that, you know, finding that trusting professional relationship, if I think, let's back up for a minute to talk a little bit about how you did come to work together.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, Amanda, did you have an agent for the book?
Yes.
And was it done? I mean, you have an agent because of your other work, yes?
Well, I did, but then I accidentally dated him. And so then I was like, okay, you're fired as my boyfriend and you're fired as my agent. So that happened. So I didn't have an agent for a long time. And then when I was working on getting this, like, just out of my body, I realized when I was about 100 pages in that it was okay and that it could be something. And so I started reaching out to agents, and I reached out to 4. And here's how I did it and how you should do it, because my impulse was to start at the very bottom and to just reach out to the agents I knew were not very difficult to get and not very competitive and would just take it. And that's why I was like, good, great to know that's your impulse. Do the exact opposite. So I started right from the top. And I reached out to 4 agents, and there were sort of 2 of the top, and then 2 right below them, and the 2 right below them didn't want it, and the 2 on top both wanted it.
Ah.
So I had to make a decision, and I called the first agent wanted to have a phone call with me, which I didn't love. I thought, you know, if you're going to be my agent, like, maybe we should meet. But she wanted to have a phone call, and she talked about the book and had one note, and that was it. And that just wasn't enough for me. So the other agent met with me, and like we had like a 3-hour lunch, and he was like, here's what I think, and let's figure out the, you know, the designing principle, and he was just very hands-on, and I realized that this is what I need. I need someone to I'm collaborative. I need to work with someone. So I went with him. And
so you had 100 pages. Mm-hmm. You obviously had written other books before. So when you say you went for the top agents, you have a little bit more insider info into that concept?
Yeah, I do. I also was very fortunate in the sense that I, not just that I had other books, but which I don't think made the difference. I think what made the difference was that I had a reading series for 15 years. And it was popular. And I knew and had been working with editors and agents and publicists for 15 years.
Yeah.
So I could email an agent and they would write me back.
Yeah.
Because they knew me as the happy ending person, that was the name of my series, who would maybe book one of our authors. So I did have an in. I still would say, like, there's different top, you know, but if you make a list and there are 10 agents on your list and you're like, well, these guys have, you know, I don't know, David Mitchell and Alex Chi or whoever, start there.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be, even though Alex has Andrew Wiley, so don't start there. But, you know, it doesn't have to be the top. It could be here, and that's, you know.
And obviously you knew they all represented memoir or nonfiction or, right?
Yeah, I mean, the thing for me is that I write three, I mean, I guess now I write three different things, even though I'm never writing another memoir. But I write kids' books and adult novels and now memoirs. So I wanted someone who represented sort of all of it, even though my agent doesn't represent kids' books, but I might force him to.
Yeah. So you had 100 pages, you got your agent, and
yes.
Then what happened?
And then I, and then he made edits and sent them back to me, and I sort of re-edited the 100 pages, and then I was like, okay, I gotta do the rest. So I spent a year, maybe a year and a half, writing the rest. And then we just kept on working on it, and then when he thought it was ready to send out, and I didn't agree. I didn't think it was quite ready to send out. But I was also done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that was a tricky moment, because I was like, I don't feel it's ready to go. I cannot bear to look at it anymore. So he sent it out to 12 people around the time that Trump was being inaugurated. So I was terrified about that timing. I also was very hands-off about it, because I don't want to hear about rejection. I don't want to hear it. I'm too sensitive. So I said, just tell me good news and don't forward me any rejection letter. Just tell me good news. Tell me who I'm meeting with and when I'm meeting them, and that is it. And so that's what happened. And then I heard, oh, I like those shoes. And then I heard, things from people. And I liked what Millicent had. I liked Millicent. She's the one I liked. Mm-hmm. I liked her. And, and I liked what she had to say about the book, and I had a meeting with the people.
Yeah, the associate publisher and publicist. People came in to sort of, because on our end, we also want to know that we like the author.
Right.
Which is not, it's not that we only publish likable authors, but
it helps.
It helps. But it's also, we fall in love with the book, but then we need to know who the person is who's writing it, figure out what kind of publicity, campaign, if it's a very shy, very private person, that'll inform what makes sense to do for publicity. Maybe it's NPR interviews instead of going all over the country, things like that. And also just to hear more about your book, about your ideas for marketing, and Amanda impressed the heck out of everybody in our office, and we made the deal.
Now, when you read the manuscripts, what was it that you
There were a lot of things. At the low end of the things that I fell in love with, or the low end of things that changed my mind, was the fact that I also, knew of Amanda's work and had always sort of admired her, and so immediately when her, the email from the agent came in with her name attached, I was like, oh, this is somebody, I'm going to want to read this soon, because I know she's, really, vibrant and well-known and a really smart person who I'm interested in. So, but then it was the book itself, and it was really, for me as an acquiring editor, I do a decent number of memoirs, and for me the thing about the memoir is, I'm not publishing the memoir because it's an exciting story. I could publish I lived, for
in a bag,
6 months. Exactly. Yeah. The ones that are purely just here's this crazy thing that happened in my life. To me, the memoirs that stick with me are the ones that aren't about that specific person and that specific life event. It's about the way that this person's experience reflects on sort of humans in general and our shared experience and the ways that there's something in that specific event that speaks to everyone. So for me, it was Amanda's depiction of childhood. You know, whether you're a child with anxiety or not, you know, everybody is somewhere on that spectrum. And also the relationship stuff, the craving for a family, the wondering if, you know, when you're gonna, you know, find your person and have your kids, if you're gonna have kids, and you know, all of that. Plus, you know, I think the anxiety was really powerful. Again, this was like right as the inauguration was happening, and everyone who read it was immediately sucked in by the voice, you know, by the character of this child who sees the world in really interesting ways. I mean, the opening like three pages of the book is how Amanda, as a kindergartner or first grader, can't figure out how to read time. She's like, why are there two 12s? Like, how do you know what's going on? And you think, like, I don't remember learning to tell time, but it opened this kind of window into, yes, like, how absurd clocks are. And, like, it really, I don't know, there was something, I felt like she had not only shined a light on my life and everyone else's life, but had also sort of given us a new angle into what it means to be human. So, awesome.
Do you have a question about this?
Yeah.
So to the end of integrating a personal story with a larger narrative, I was wondering if you could talk about the decision to weave in the stories of the lost children. How did that happen?
Okay, so that was actually due to my friend Robert Lopez, who's an excellent writer, who read a draft of the book before I sent it out. And he said, you know, you only have this one chapter about Eitan Peetz, but your whole existence is about being terrified of disappearing, and I think that you're not utilizing this loss in the best way you can. And if I were you, I would pull that out. And he said, because it did follow you. You talk about it still, and you're 116, so like you should pull it out. So I did, and I think I wrote you or yeah. Bill or someone and said, like, yeah, I've confused you with Bill all the time, and said, hey, let's do this, and she agreed, and I thought it was a really smart, wise idea, and it did, it worked, it was really helpful.
Well, because it also, it speaks to what you just said, Millicent, in that it kind of makes your story it connects it to the larger, mm-hmm. you know, universe and what was going on during the 70s and 80s
right.
and that whole concept of lost children. I mean, he was the first one that was on the
book. He wasn't.
Right? Oh, he wasn't.
He wasn't. But that is a myth.
That's a myth, right?
Can
I mean, it's
keep
like, yeah.
Perpetuating. I think it was Jacob Wetterling, actually. But he was the one who sort of popularized the whole.
Right, and that concept.
Missing kid thing.
Made it trendy.
Yeah, they made it so trendy.
Yeah,
everyone wanted to do it.
Yeah. But it speaks to the 70s and 80s. You know, it speaks to our culture at the time and this feeling of there being this, you know, danger, risky mm-hmm. thing, and families sort of falling apart in a certain
right.
way.
And,
yeah.
Can you talk a little bit, because I noticed the passage you read was in present tense about... I'm not a writer, so I mean, this might be a tool that everybody else knows about, but particularly when you're writing memoir, about the power of using the present tense to make your voice feel very immediate,
mm-hmm.
Because what I noticed about that passage is that, number one, I have started using that as a tool for myself to force myself to walk through the moment so that I'm writing it in a way that really clearly and accurately depicts detail, right? If I force myself mentally to go into those little rooms
right.
and explore them really thoroughly, I write it very differently than if I'm writing it in the past tense.
Right.
So did you find that, for instance, particularly if you were feeling stuck about how to write about a certain part of your life, that if you very deliberately put yourself in the present tense, that it made your voice feel more urgent?
Well, yeah, but it wasn't really a decision.
It
was always very clear to me that it was in the present tense. And the other thing is that we are all in the present tense all the time. And when you have an anxiety disorder, you're especially in the present tense. And the reason that it was, you know, some of the kid stuff feels, I think, so real to people is that I'm still in the present tense as a kid. So it's not like I had to spend months like reading old journals and, you know, watching movies and trying to remember, go visit schools. It's right here.
Yeah.
So I thought it was really important, like if I want people to experience the somatic symptoms of anxiety, to really feel it, then I have to put them in my body, and I am in the present tense, no matter what age I'm at. I do want to go back for 1 second and say that the Eitan Peetz thing, threading through, the other thing that I think, the other reason I think it worked, and something I think to keep in mind, is that it gave the story a mystery. So there was some sort of, you know, thing that people kept on reading for to, you know, say anxiety doesn't have such a mystery. There's no real mystery there. But so I think that that's another element that it added a level of intrigue.
Well, I think we're also reading towards your diagnosis.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a lot of the childhood parts where Amanda's like, am I just dumb? Am I, you know, like, why am I getting tested? Like, is it that the writing's too small? Is this sense of, like, trying to figure out what's wrong with you? And I feel like every kid, you know, even the most, like, perfect kids out there feel this sense that there's something that makes them different from other people.
Right.
And so, you know, like, those of us reading the book understand what it is, but when you're inside the book and you're in the moment and you are that child, like, you're like, desperate to find what it is that's wrong and get it solved. And so, because Amanda wasn't diagnosed until she was 25, you know, she's living through this childhood period with no help and a mother who's just like, let's get you a tutor to follow a map. You know, like, she, you know, I found, as a reader, you sort of barrel through the story that way, too.
So. Well, that's good to see. Yeah.
Just to continue on the line that we were talking about before, once you guys decided to work together,
mm-hmm.
how many times did you go through an editorial process, editing process?
1,001.
what was that working relationship like?
We met a few times.
A few times.
And then I just remember a lot of suffering, pain, tears, agony. Millicent would send me chunks and say, have at it, and I need it back in 2 weeks.
I didn't do that.
3 weeks. All right, a month.
But it would be edits. It would be a chunk with edits.
It would be a chunk with edits, but it was like a little bit of a. I mean, for me, because I get so overwhelmed with like directions or instructions. I was like, I need a week to like calm down in order to just process the notes. But it was like a map in a way. Like this chunk belongs here. One of the things that Millicent did that was really helpful for me, and is obvious to literally everyone else in the world, but not me. So when I wrote this book, it sort of mirrored living inside anxiety. So there, I would mix places and times, and poor Millicent was like trying to get lice out of. She was like, okay, let's like take all the lice and we'll put them over here. So she would go in and say like, okay, well, this is all like all the stuff that takes place in the garden and all the stuff that takes place with your mom. Like, let's section them out and give them their own spots. And I was like, huh? And, well, you know, but it made sense. And I thought, my thing was, but no, it's about anxiety. It's not going to work if it's so organized. But it worked better organized.
Yeah. Well, and it wasn't even so much, let's talk about the garden, let's talk about your mom, but it was like, let's, you know, the way you talk about the garden is this Eden where, you know, like you and the other kids, it's where you were happy, it's where you belonged, it's where you knew what was going on, and it was the safe space. And then she describes, like, the other side of the house and the street where all the, like, mafiosos are mm-hmm. doing their thing, you know, and so it was a matter of, like, starting in the purest spot, and expanding out and showing the complexity. So once we established the street side versus the garden side of life, then it was a matter of who's your family, and establishing the relationship with your mom, and
right.
that because that's like a foundational part,
right.
not just of the book, but everybody and you and all of that. And then it was the movement to school, and so you're in really sort of broad, obnoxiously symbolic and metaphoric kind of way, it's just like going from, through the stages, like the Freudian stages of childhood,
right.
really. So
right.
that was part of it, too, was just like help the reader make a journey with you.
Right. And I had a hard time separating out, Millicent was like, let's build up, let's not overwhelm everyone right up. And I was like, but it was overwhelming all the time. And she was like, okay, I get that, but let's not overwhelm the reader. And I remember she said to me early on, I'm on page 5 and I'm having a panic attack. And I was like, great. And she was like, no, it's a long book. Let's try and draw that out. I was like, oh, I guess. Early on, it came with a bottle of Xanax. It was really...
So that just sounds amazing to have that kind of structural perspective,
It was amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
So how long did that kind of back and forth take until you had something to do?
About a year.
Okay.
Yeah. But it was amazing. I mean, it was really difficult. She had me do things that, I didn't want to do or didn't know how to do, and I'm so grateful for it, and that I learned basically how to structure a book because I went to Millicent grad school, and but it was really it's the, for me, the best way for me to learn is by doing, and I'm experiential, and this was the greatest way for me to write a book was to do it with someone else and to have someone who knows what they're doing be like, and who's diplomatic as fuck. I mean, oh my God, this woman is so patient and so calm and so grounded and so diplomatic. I was like, I'd be hysterical, and then I'd be like, at 5 minutes, I'd be like, okay, I got it. Okay. And then we'll do it. But so it was, it was really... I don't even remember the question.
Yes.
Earlier you discussed how writing about your childhood was super easy and it happened really quick, and then when you were writing about present day, you were stuck.
Yes.
And I know you said that you had a lot of, help getting to that present day. Any pointers? And why does that happen?
I think because you're in it.
Yeah, which you think would make it easier, but it's harder.
I think it's harder to... know your own themes,
right?
And to know what your patterns are, really. And I think it's so much, it's helpful to have someone else be like, here's what you're living through, here's what you're trying to find. So I had all the present day stuff, but Millicent was the one who was like, don't think you need this, don't think you need this, don't think you need this, because I think what you're actually saying is something different. And then once it was sort of, pointed out, it was much easier.
Yeah, I think the present day stuff, you really are in it. And you also, on a purely sort of narrative level, you don't know what your turning points are yet.
Right.
Your narrative of the last day could be totally different, because if you walk outside and you... God forbid, see somebody hit by a bus. That changes everything.
Right.
You're in the before right now, and you have no idea.
Right.
So it takes somebody who knows, who can stand back and say, these are the events of those hours of that day, right before you saw the person get hit by the bus, and that's, the shape of the story that you're telling. In the moment, you don't know what the story is that you need to tell yet, because you don't know if it's more important that you, had food poisoning last week, or that, your boyfriend's going to break up with you in, next week. And I think, again, like, you can't step back, because if you step back, you bring it all with you. So you need somebody else. And I think that's one of the values of an editor, just to say, like, you know, here... And I mean, as an editor, especially of memoir, you know, and I respect memoirists so much, because I just think that's got to be the hardest thing in the world. And I try to, you know, not sort of go in and say, this is the shape of your life, even though I'm doing it based on what's in the book. But, like, it has to be a back and forth, because mm-hmm. there may be, you know, you may feel, and I feel like we had this conversation where it was like, I don't, as a reader, understand why this chapter is here. I don't understand why you're telling this story, because it seems to be totally separate from everything else. Mm-hmm. And then it's a matter of sort of going in and the author being able to articulate what it is about that story that feels like it needs telling, and you can, like, untangle that later on.
Can you guys, as a team, elaborate a little bit more on that? Because that's actually some of the feedback I've gotten from friends reading, is you have this in here, and I don't know why you haven't tied it into these other themes that I see. Because my own struggle is with perfectionism as opposed to anxiety, and as somebody who's, like, not famous and not a previously published author, right, I don't have a sense of when some good writing reaches an editor from somebody who doesn't have a prior platform. What's their expectation in terms of how organized it already is with regards to, for instance, themes? You know, how done do you really need or expect it to be before it catches your eye and seems like a ready project?
For me, it's, you know, I'm in a lucky spot where I've always done literary projects. You know, I don't have to choose based on someone's, like, YouTube followers. Thankfully, that's not the sort of publishing that I do. You know, there are definitely people who do that, and they probably make a lot more money than I do. But I did poetry in the early part of my career. I've always done fiction and nonfiction, both, you know, creative nonfiction and, you know, like, history narrative nonfiction type things. And for me, in every case, across all of those things, it's about the story. It's about what has captured me. But it's not about the story of the person living in the bag. It's the story. It's the way that the story resonates for me as a human being. Mm-hmm. You know, the way that it speaks to me. So, you know, and that's what makes me fall in love. That's what makes me say, I need to publish this. I don't care, you know, who this author is. I don't care, you know, if they live in a hut in New Zealand and we're never going to be able to get them in front of, you know, readers at BNN or, like, whatever obstacles there are. If I fall in love with the book, then I am, you know, as I will fight to be able to acquire it. So it's not, you know, like, none of us is going in, like, we're not going in to do, like, you know, literary criticism on our submissions. We're going in to fall in love. And so it's not so much about themes. There are ways in which themes can amplify the experience of the book, you know, where you realize that, you know, this thing at the end totally highlights, you know, how much the author has changed since a similar event happened, you know, in chapter 3. That's part of the experience of the book. So the answer is both things. Like, don't worry about the themes, but also it should be the best book it can be. You know, and it should be a book that appears to, you know, really speak to people. So, you know, and are all, you know, sort of friends. I cringe sometimes as an editor when I give advice to an author and the author says, but my friends all read it and they think whatever.
I'm guilty of that. Mine is more like, but my writing group.
Yeah, in fairness, your friends in your writing group are also all writers.
Yes.
So, you know, but you know, I both want to listen to that, because the truth is, like, it needs to speak to readers who are not editors. It needs to speak to people's friends. On the other hand, people's friends know more about the life, especially if it's a memoir, know more about what's going on, have their own expectations, and come to it not really as fresh readers. You know, they're not even quite as objective as I am. So, anyway, I don't know how I got off on that.
I have a question that maybe I'm not even sure how to phrase, but I'm wondering, as an editor, when you read a story that you fall in love with, because in some ways I'm my own editor at this point, and you know, but I also see some various options for how to structure. And so I'm wondering if you could give us some insight, like you read something you're in love with, like what is some of the thought process that you go through when you start to say, is this the best shape for this story? And how do you kind of play with different, like what's your process, or is there a process, or is every book so different that it's, you know, unique, but like is there some kind of general sense of like what you start to ask yourself when you think about how to structure the best way to tell a story?
Something has always made me fall in love with it, whether it is just an echo of themes and the rest of it's kind of a mess, but I feel like, I've talked to the author and I know that she's open to edits and, you know, then, like, let's figure this out. Sometimes I read, you know, I read it through and I'm, like, hooked beginning to end and, you know, then there isn't something obvious that I feel like I want to go in and change. But for literally every book, I acquire it, and then I read it through again. And when I, you'll read it in the acquisitions process, like often, you know, the agent sent it out to 12 other people. There are other editors who have fallen in love with it too. You know, they're getting money from their publishers. You're heading into an auction. You're like, I gotta find out what happens and like do this thing. Put together your financial information. So I read it again calmly as a reader. But I read it as a reader with what I always imagine. Maybe I'm crazy. Little editor on my shoulder who watches me read. Mm-hmm. So and I have a little stack of post-it notes next to me. My core assistant has to order them by the like ton. And I will just put a flag every time I see myself as a reader say, wait a minute, or like, gosh, I wish I knew that earlier, or wait, or like, who is this character, or hey, like, is this a trap, like, has this character set up, whatever, and whether it's like, you know, my theory on like what the mystery is going to be, or whether it's confusion or like particular joy, you know, and being like, wow, you really nailed that. I will flag those for myself, but I put them on the post-it note specifically so I can take them off before I mail it to the author, because sometimes I'm like, oh my god, what are you doing? But I do that, and then I read it through again. Now that I know the full shape of the book and what the author wanted to do, you know, like, maybe she meant for us to be confused at that point. Maybe she meant for us to be confused, but I don't think that's the best decision. Then I'll sit down and I'll say, okay, how do I accomplish the, you know, ambiguity that she intended for that spot, but in a way that doesn't frustrate the reader? And then I sort of sit through, puzzle it through myself, pull what I can from other spots where I'm like, well, you know, if we had half of this piece of information here and leave the other one later, then we feel like, you know, we can trust the author to carry us through whatever it is. You know, I'll figure out the problems and then I'll go back in and puzzle it out. And a lot of the times I'll do it myself and then present it to the author and say, like, I could be totally wrong. Like, this is the problem I was trying to solve. This was the idea I came up with. Let's talk about it if it sounds wrong to you. And sometimes, I mean, every once in a while, I'll just be like, I still have no idea why this chapter is in here, so my recommendation is to cut it. But if you, like, don't feel like that's the right thing to do, let's talk. Like, let's have a 3-hour coffee date and figure out what it is about this piece of your story that's essential so we know why it's there. But it's very individualized to each book in that sense, but I think it's very helpful to watch yourself read it. Which is, in some ways, you know, a privilege that only the editor can have, because the author, of course, doesn't know what the reader doesn't know. So, that's why you need somebody else.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yes. Maybe this is going off topic, but something that I've been thinking about a lot in reading nonfiction
memoir, and how far sort of off the line from, you know, exact this is what happened do you sort of see, or do you sort of allow these books to flavor, like how does that work, this whole idea now?
Yes, that's my question, isn't it?
That's good.
Well, as the editor, you know, and as the sort of representative of the publishing house in that relationship, most of the time, you know, like, it was kind of rare for me to already know who the author of a debut memoir was. Most of the time, the author and I are complete strangers, and I have to kind of take on faith a lot of what is in the memoir. We don't do fact checking. You know, we'll like make sure street names are spelled right. But you know, and if anybody remembers the James Fry saying, like, mm-hmm. the publisher got a lot of, you know, slack for that, and like maybe publishing should have it, but it's not something that like the industry can afford, honestly. It's not something that we can be responsible for. Mm-hmm. So we have to trust our authors. And there have been times when I've turned down projects because I was like, I don't believe this. Like, I just don't believe that this is true. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's certain parts of memoirs or of you know, stories that obviously have had to come out of your imagination, like conversations, mm-hmm. You know, that where you weren't there, or conversations that happened when you were a baby, or, yeah. And you know, I the goal is, you know, tell the truth, but tell the truth as you experienced it. So there, you know, as much as possible, the idea is get it correctly down on paper, and then we can figure out ways around, you know, things that you need to imagine. You know, and then there's, of course, like, the legal question. Like, don't accuse, you know, somebody of doing something that you know is not true, or that you can't back up in a court of law if necessary, because that person, you know, as long as they're a private citizen, can, you know, sue you when the book comes out. So,
yeah.
But I know that wasn't really the question you were asking. You know, it was much more of a kind of creative, like...
Can I answer that part? I'm going to add to that. A lot of, you know, I wrote starting from the time I was six, and I don't remember what she said, what I said, what she said, but I remember being confused about not knowing how to tell time, why there are two 12s, and that I confided in my best friend about it, and that she was always the one who the teacher would like pull to help me. So those things are all true. And what my task was to take the things that were true and construct the scene that I remember to an extent, but not perfectly. So it's almost like playing a game of matching to the shape and of the memory, or what you know the topic was. I know how I felt when I would leave my mom's to go to my dad's. That the feeling and the burning and the pressure and the tugging and the heat and the countdowns, and like the way that I suffered, is true. I didn't remember how we got there. So, and it's because I was panicking. So I had to call my brother, my sister, and say, like, how do we get to Dad's house? I didn't remember that. But they told me. So that was true. So I put that in the book, and I would have to write to the feeling, which was true. So things like you sort of take these, you know, if the emotion is true, and you know that you were, like, fighting with your mom about a party, and you know how you got into the argument and how you left it, you know, you work with that.
Yeah, because the dialogue is something I
you're not going to remember it.
Sort of, yeah, how you felt.
But I think that's okay. I mean,
yeah.
I really do. It's okay if you know what the topic was, if you know what it was you were I think when people say things like on Amazon or Goodreads, like, I just do not believe that she remembers everything. Like, of course I don't remember.
Right.
Like, who does? And
right.
that you would read a memoir thinking that I would, you know, there's some poetic license you take, but you don't lie.
Yeah. I think it's about being true to the experience.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate even further? I mean, I'm often finding myself saying, I don't remember how we got there. Like, it feels like Christine Blasey Ford, you know what I mean? Like, nobody's
right.
going to take it seriously because, what, you don't remember what happened right before that bomb went off or something? Like, no, I don't. Like, how often did you find yourself supposed to, for instance, asking your brothers and sisters, how did that unfold?
Often.
Saying, I don't remember. I don't remember how that happened, but this is how I felt about it.
Well, I have two answers. One is, depending on what you're writing, I think it's okay to say, I don't remember.
Right.
I think that's interesting.
Yeah,
I think that's interesting. And that was a choice that I was thinking of making. Mm-hmm. But for me, there are moments when I would say, don't remember, but very rarely.
Yeah.
It just didn't feel like the right, it felt, for this book, a bit like a cop-out. Yeah, cheap, because I was so primal in a way, and visceral, and I didn't want to cheat out of that. So, but I do think it's an option for certain books. And then the other way is, what was the other way? So sometimes you just don't remember, and you can write about that, and other times you can find out as much as you know and just write to that, and if you just don't remember, then you either can't write about it or you just admit you don't remember.
Just as an example, I worked on Susanna Cahalan's Brain on Fire, and she, you know, the first part is her experience before the breakdown, the last part is her recovery from the medical emergency, but during like the key midsection of the book, the 5 weeks where mm-hmm. everything's taking place, she blacked out. She's missing 5 weeks of her life from, like, her first seizure. This is a woman who had, like, a...
aneurysm?
No.
Stroke?
I'm trying to... Whatever it is, where your body rejects stuff. Anyway, forget it.
When your body
she
rejects.
Had a brain... not a hemorrhage.
Not
like,
an aneurysm?
Seizure. Fridays, man.
Yeah.
I'm really familiar with that. But it's a really long diagnosis. And
very
rare. But
yeah, I know. I wasn't going to say what the diagnosis was. It was basically her body rejected itself, whatever that broad term is for those diseases. And which is really... Yes, thank you.
Autoimmune.
See?
I know. I wouldn't have come up with that.
My brain left. I'm sorry. She had an autoimmune disorder that caused, like, inflammation in her brain, and she...
I do not want that.
Started having seizures and lost a chunk of her life, and the doctors thought she was going to end up in a mental institution. She had really, really quick onset schizophrenia, and they were sort of giving up on her, and then they did a spinal tap and brain biopsy and found out that it was this autoimmune disorder that had, you know, set off this crazy thing in her brain. So she, anyway, but for the middle 5 weeks of the book, she, like, just wasn't there. And in the early drafts of the book, she had wanted to switch to the third person and refer to herself as the patient.
Mm.
Because all of that was based on her research, you know, from her hospital records, from her father's diary, all of this stuff. And she felt that it would be most honest to do it from this outside perspective. And from an editorial point of view... We had a long back and forth about it, but I was like, I think we need to be with you. Even though you can acknowledge that you were not conscious during this time, you still need to reconstruct what is happening to Susanna. And in a way, staying in the first person while only having outside information actually helps demonstrate the, you know, that kind of literal out-of-body experience. You know, but all of that, like the whole center of the book, is based on her research as an outsider to her own life. So, you know, you can reconstruct things that way and be true to what was really happening just through your stylistic choices, through, you know, all of that. But, yeah.
So it's 11:15, 11:17. I think we have to wrap up for because we're going to move into the opening lines clinic now. So I just want to thank you guys so much. It seems like what an amazing relationship.
Thank you. Thank you.